It wasn't him, John said again, and she looked up.
Right. Right, of course it wasn't, she whispered.
Of course it wasn't him, she said at a normal pitch.
Of course not, he echoed.
She nodded, bobbing her head up and down like she was gathering momentum.
I want to go back to the house one more time, she said. I want you to come with me.
Of course, he said. She nodded again, then turned her face back up to the sky. Chapter 8
Charlie!
Someone was at the door, knocking loud enough to rattle the old hinges. Charlie roused slowly, her eyes sticky with sleep, but this time at least she knew where she was. She had left the window open, and now the air coming in had a fresh, heavy smell. It was the scent of coming rain, mossy and rich. She got up and looked out the window, inhaling deeply. Unlike most of the world, the woods outside looked almost the same in the morning as they had in the dark. Charlie and John had gone back to bed soon after they finished talking. John had looked at her like there was more he wanted to say, but she had pretended not to notice. She was grateful to him for being there, for giving her what she needed without having to ask, because she would never have asked.
Charlie!
The banging came again, and she gave in.
I'm up, Marla,
she shouted back.
Charlie!
Now Jason was joining in the game, knocking and rattling, and Charlie groaned and went to the door.
I said I'm up, she said, mock glaring out at them. Charlie!
Jason shouted again, and this time Marla shushed him. He grinned up at Charlie, and she laughed and shook her head.
Believe me, I'm awake, she said.
Marla was fully dressed, her hair a little damp from the shower, and her eyes were bright and alert.
Are you always like this?
Charlie said, her grumpiness only half invented.
Like what?
Chipper at 6 in the morning, she said, and rolled her eyes at Jason, who copied her, happy to be included. Marla smiled brightly.
It's 8. Come on, there's been talk of breakfast.
Has there been talk of coffee? Charlie followed Marla and Jason down the stairs to the kitchen, where she found Lamar and John already seated around a high, modern-looking wood table. Carlton's father was at the stove, making pancakes.
It smells like rain, Charlie said, and Lamar nodded.
There's a thunderstorm coming, he said. It was on the news earlier, he told us.
He jerked a thumb at Clay.
It's a big one, Clay exclaimed in response.
We're supposed to leave today, Jason said.
We'll see, Marla said.
Charlie,
Clay cried, not taking his eyes off his work.
1, 2, or 3?
2, Charlie said. Thanks. Is there coffee?
Help yourself. Mug's in the cupboard, Clay said, gesturing to a full pot on the counter.
Charlie helped herself, waving off offers of milk, cream, half and half, sugar or fake sugar.
Thanks,
she said quietly as she settled herself beside Lamar, meeting John's eyes briefly.
Did Carlton come in?
Lamar shook his head, a tight jerk to the side.
He hasn't turned up yet, Clay said. Probably isn't awake yet, wherever he is.
He placed a full plate in front of Charlie, who dug in, not realizing how hungry she was until she was already chewing. She was about to ask where Carlton was likely to be when Jessica appeared, yawning, her clothes unrumpled, unlike Charlie's.
You're late, Marla teased, and Jessica stretched elaborately. I don't get out of bed until the pancakes are ready, she said.
And with impeccable timing, Clay slapped one onto a plate, fresh off the pan.
Well, you're just in time, he said.
Suddenly, his expression changed, wavering somehow between apprehension and relief. Charlie turned in her seat. There was a woman standing behind her, dressed in a gray skirt suit,
her blonde hair shellacked against her head as if she were a plastic toy. "Are we a Waffle House now?" she asked. She looked around the kitchen briefly. "Pancakes," Jessica corrected, but no one responded.
"Betty," Clay cried. "You remember the boys? And this is Charlie, Jessica, and Marla, and Jason."
He pointed to each in turn, and Carlton's mother gave each of them a nod, like she was tallying them up. "Clay, I have to be in court in an hour."
"Betty's the DA for the county,"
Clay went on as if he had not heard her.
"I catch the crooks, she puts him back out on the streets."
"Yes, our family is a full-service operation," she said dryly, pouring herself coffee and settling down at the table beside Jessica. "Speaking of which, where's our young felon to be?" Clay hesitated.
"Another one of his pranks," he said. "He'll be back home later, I'm sure."
Their eyes met, and something private passed between them. Betty broke away with a laugh that sounded a little forced. "Oh, Lord, what is it this time?" There was a moment's pause. In the morning light, the story sounded insane, and Charlie had no idea where to begin. With a nervous clearing of his throat, Lamar started to explain.
We went up to the mall construction site to go see what was left of Freddy Fazbear's."
At the name, Betty's head jerked up, and she gave a quick nod. "Go on," she said, her voice suddenly cold and clipped. Lamar explained awkwardly, and Marla and Jason jumped in with details. After a few minutes, Carlton's mother had a messy version of the truth. As she listened, her face hardened until it looked like plaster. She was a statue of herself. She shook her head as they finished. Small, rapid movements, and Charlie thought she looked like she was not just trying to deny what they were saying, but to shake the knowledge entirely from her mind.
"You have to go get him, Clay, right now," she demanded. "Send someone. How could you wait all night?"
She set her coffee on the table more forcefully than she should have, spilling a little, then went to the phone and started dialing.
"Who are you calling?" Clay said, alarmed.
"The police," she snapped.
"I am the police."
"Then why are you here instead of finding my son?" Clay opened and closed his mouth helplessly for a moment before finding his bearings.
"Betty, it's just another joke. Remember the frogs?"
She set the phone back on its hook and turned to face him, her eyes smoldering. Charlie could suddenly see her standing righteous before a jury, wreaking the wrath of the law.
"Clay?"
Her voice was low and steady, a dangerous calm.
"How could you not wake me up? How could you not tell me this? Betty, you were asleep. It's just Carlton being Carlton. I didn't want to disturb you."
"Did you think I would be less disturbed when I woke up and found him missing?"
"I thought he would be back by now," Clay protested. "This is different," she said with finality. "It's Freddy's."
"I don't understand Freddy's. I know what happened there, what happened to those kids," he retorted. "I don't understand. For goodness sake, Betty, I saw Michael's blood streaked across the floor where he was dragged from—"
He stopped, realizing too late that he was surrounded by the teenagers. He looked around at them, near panic, but his wife had not noticed, or, Charlie thought, she just did not care.
"Well, you didn't see him," Betty snapped. "Do you remember what you told Carlton? Be tough, be brave, little soldier." "So he was brave. He was a little soldier for you. He was shattered, Clay. He had lost his best friend, had Michael snatched away right in front of him. Let me tell you something, Chief. That boy has thought about Michael every single day of his life for the last 10 years. I have seen him stage jokes so elaborate they deserve to be mounted as performance art pieces. but there is no way on earth that Carlton would desecrate Michael's memory by making Freddy's a joke. Call someone right now.
Clay looked slightly shocked, but he gathered himself quickly and left the room. Charlie heard a door slam shut behind him. Betty looked around at the teenagers, breathing hard as if she had been running.
Everything is going to be fine, she said tightly. If he is trapped in there, we will get him out. What do you kids have planned for the day?
The question was inane, as if they were all going to hang out at the park or go to a movie while Carlton might be in danger.
We were supposed to leave today, Marla said.
Obviously we won't,
Lamar said hastily, but Betty did not seem to be listening to them.
I'll have to call in to work, she said distractedly and went to the phone to make the call.
Charlie looked at John, who jumped to the rescue.
We were going to go to the library, he said. We had some things we wanted to investigate, research.
He blushed faintly when he said it, and Charlie knew why. It was absurd to be talking like this, about cases and disappearances and murders. But Marla was nodding.
Yeah, we'll all go, she said,
and Charlie's heart sank. There was no reason she couldn't just tell them all that she wanted to go back to her old house, just her and John. No one would be hurt. But that wasn't the problem. Even sharing the knowledge felt too much like exposure. Carlton's mother hung up the phone, done with her call.
I hate this, she announced to the room in general, her careful, controlled voice almost shaking. I hate this.
Charlie and the others jumped in unison, startled by the sudden outburst.
And now, like always, I get to sit here by myself, hoping and praying that everyone will be okay.
Charlie looked at Marla, who shrugged helplessly. Lamar cleared his throat nervously.
I think we'll stick around for another day, he said.
There was a pause, then Marla and Jessica jumped in to help.
Yeah, traffic is crazy out there, Jessica said,
high-pitched and forced.
Yeah, and also because of the storm, and it's not like we're going to have fun knowing he's missing, Marla said. I guess you're stuck with us.
Jessica flashed an anxious smile at Carlton's mother, who did not seem to register it.
Come on, John said before anyone else could speak.
He and Charlie hurried out of the house and got into the car. Charlie heaved a sigh of relief as she started the engine.
That was awful, she said.
Yeah.
He gave her a worried look.
What do you think about Carlton?
Charlie didn't answer until she was safely backed out of the driveway.
I think his mom is right, she said, pulling into gear. I think last night we all let ourselves believe what we wanted to believe.
Officer Dunn pulled to a stop in the mall parking lot, responding to Chief Burke's order to return. In the light of day, it was just an abandoned construction site, an ugly blemish on the flat desert landscape.
You can't tell from looking if it's being built up or torn down, Dunn thought. Can't tell creation from destruction at a distance.
He liked the phrase. He turned it over in his head for a moment, staring at the place. On impulse, he radioed dispatch.
Hey, Nora, he said.
Dunn, she answered crisply. What's going on?
Back at the mall for another look, he said.
Ooh, bring me back a soft pretzel, she teased.
He laughed and broke the connection. As he walked briskly through the mall, Dunn was at least grateful the children were not there this time. As the youngest member of the Hurricane Police Department, Dunn always took care to think of teenagers as children, even though he knew how small the gap between them was. If he could bring them to believe he was a responsible adult, hopefully at some point he would believe it too. Dunn flipped on his flashlight as he reached the entrance to the narrow alleyway that led to Freddy Fazbear's. He swept the beam up and down the walls ahead of him, but the alley was empty of life. He took a deep breath and went in. Dunn kept to the wall, his shoulder brushing lightly against the rough brick as he tried to avoid the puddles that pooled beneath leaky pipes. The bright beam of his flashlight illuminated the alley almost as well as overhead bulbs, but somehow the light was not comforting. It only made the place look stark and grim, the shelves of tools and rejected paint cans now woeful and exposed. As he moved toward the door to the restaurant, something tiny and cold landed on his head, and he startled, swinging his light up like a weapon and pressing his back against the wall as defense against the threat. Another cold drop of water landed on his cheek. He took deep breaths. When at last he reached the outer door to the restaurant, the shelf that had blocked it was gone. The chains that had seemed so permanently fixed in place were hanging loose, and the door was cracked open slightly. The immense, rusted padlock lay in the dirt, its shackle hanging open. Dunn kicked it away from the door. He dug his fingers into the gap, prying until he could get a grip on it, then pulled at the door with both hands until it screeched open wide enough for him to enter. He crept down the inner passage with his light held out in front, hugging the wall tight to one side. The air seemed to change as he moved closer to the interior of the restaurant, and Dunn felt a crawling chill that penetrated his uniform and fed his growing anxiety.
"Don't freak out, Dunn," he said out loud, then felt instantly foolish.
He reached the main dining area and stopped, sweeping the light over each wall in turn. The light seemed dimmer inside, swallowed by the space. The room was empty, but it was just as he remembered from when he was a kid. He had been 10 when the tragedies started, 11 when they ended. His birthday party was supposed to be at Freddy's, but after the first disappearance his mother had canceled it, invited his friends to his house, and hired a clown, which proved equally terrifying.
"Smart move, Mom," Dunn thought.
The beam played over the little carousel, which he had never ridden, claiming he was too old for it. Just before the beam of light reached the stage, Dunn stopped, swallowing hard. "The rabbit took him," the kid had said. Dunn shook himself and played the light across the stage. The figures were there, just as he remembered, and, unlike the carousel, they did not seem diminished in size. They were exactly as he recalled, and for a moment an almost painful nostalgia swelled in his chest. As he gazed at them, remembering, he noticed that their eyes were all fixed oddly forward, like they were watching something on the far side of the room. The flashlight trained in front of him, Dunn approached the stage until he was standing only a few feet from it, and he stared up at each of the animals in turn. Bonnie was holding his guitar jauntily, as if he might begin strumming whenever the mood struck him, and Chica and her cupcake seemed to be sharing some arcane secret. Freddy, with his microphone, stared out into the distance, unblinking. Something moved behind him, and Dunn whirled around, his heart racing. The flashlight found nothing, and he swept it nervously from side to side, revealing only empty tables. He glanced back nervously at Bonnie, but the rabbit was still frozen in his own inscrutable reverie. Dunn took shallow breaths, holding himself completely still, and listened, his senses kicked into high gear with adrenaline. After a moment the noise came again, a shuffling sound, this time coming from off to the right. He swept the light instantly toward it. There was an open doorway, and beyond it a hall. Crouching down, Dunn made his way down the hall, keeping to the side as though something might come running past.
"Why am I here alone?"
He knew the answer. His sergeant hadn't taken the search seriously. In truth, neither had Dunn. After all, it was just the chief's son again, making trouble.
"It's probably just Carlton," Dunn reminded himself.
He reached the end of the hall, where a door stood ajar. With one hand, Dunn gave the door an inward push, dropping low into the side as he did. The door swung inward, and nothing happened. He pulled the nightstick from his belt. Its heft was unfamiliar. He had never had much need for it in Hurricane. Now, though, he gripped its hard rubber handle like a lifeline. The office was not quite empty. There was a small desk, and a folded-up metal chair leaned against it. A large cabinet stood against one wall, its door open just a crack. There were no exits other than the one Dunn was standing in. He swept the light up and down the length of the cabinet and took a deep breath. He bounced his nightstick lightly in his hand, reassuring himself of its presence, and carefully assessed the small space. Standing to the side, he used the stick to open the door, moving slowly. It came open easily, and again, everything was still. Relieved, Dunn looked inside. The cabinet was empty, except for a costume. It was Bonnie, or rather, it wasn't. The face was the same, but the rabbit's fur was yellow. It was slumped lifelessly against the back wall of the cabinet, its eyes dark, gaping holes. The rabbit took him. The kid hadn't been lying then. Carlton must have gotten someone to dress up in this outfit to help him play his trick. Still, Dunn's unease did not abate. He did not want to touch the thing. He lowered his light and stuck his nightstick back in his belt, intending to go. Before he could turn, the costume pitched forward, landing on Dunn with the lifeless weight of a heavy corpse. For a moment it did not move, then all at once it was writhing violently, grabbing at him with strong, inhuman hands. Dunn screamed, a desperate, high sound, struggling as the rabbit gripped his shirt, then his arm. Dunn felt a sudden, vicious pain, and a small, detached part of his mind thought, "He broke it. He broke my arm." But the pain was washed numb by terror as the rabbit swung him around and slammed him into the cabinet door, taking Dunn's weight easily as if he were a child. Dunn struggled to breathe. The rabbit's arm was pressed against his neck so tightly that every movement choked him. Just when he thought he was on the brink of passing out, the pressure lifted, and Dunn gasped with relief, clutching his throat. Then he saw the knife. The rabbit held a slim silver blade. Its big, matted paws should have been too clumsy, but Dunn knew as he stared down at it that the rabbit had done this before and would easily do it again. Dunn screamed, an indistinct shriek. He had no hope that he would be heard. It was only a guttural, despairing noise. He breathed deep and did it again, a bestial sound, his whole body vibrating with it, as if this could somehow be defense against what happened next. The knife went in. Dunn felt it tear through skin and muscle, felt it sever things he could not name to plant itself deep in his chest. As he seized with pain and terror, the rabbit pulled him close, almost in an embrace. Dunn's head went light. He was losing consciousness. As he looked up, he could see two rows of smiling teeth, horrid and yellow, the costume peeling at the edges of the mouth. The two gaping holes for eyes looked down at him. They were dark and hollow, but the creature drew near enough that Dunn could see smaller eyes peering back at him from deep within the mask. They held Dunn's gaze patiently. Dunn felt his legs go numb, his vision clouding. He wanted to scream again, to somehow voice his final outrage, but he could not move his face, could not raise the breath to cry out. The rabbit held him upright, supporting his weight, and its eyes were the last thing Dunn ever saw. Charlie unlocked the front door to her old house and looked back down the front steps. "You coming?" John was still standing on the bottom step, staring up at the house. He shivered a little before hurrying to join her. "Sorry," he said sheepishly. "I just had a weird feeling for a second." Charlie laughed without much humor. "Just for a second?" They went inside, and John stopped again, looking around the front room like he had just stepped into a sacred place, somewhere that merited a humbling pause. Charlie bit her tongue, trying not to be impatient. It was how she had felt as well. She might have felt that way now if she were not overwhelmed by a sense of urgency, the feeling that the answer to everything, the answer to how to get Carlton back, must be somewhere in this place. Where else could it possibly be?
John, she said. It's okay. Come on.
He nodded and followed her up the stairs to the second floor. He stopped again briefly halfway up, and Charlie saw his eyes fixed on the dark stain that marred the wood floor of the living room.
Is,
he began to say, then swallowed it and started over.
Is Stanley still there?
Charlie pretended not to notice the lapse.
You remember his name, she said instead, grinning.
John shrugged.
Who doesn't love a mechanical unicorn?
Yeah, he's still there. All the toys still work. Come on.
They hurried the rest of the way to her room. John knelt down beside the unicorn and pressed the button that set him on his track, watching raptly as he made his squeaky way around the room. Charlie hid a smile behind her hand. John was watching intently, his face serious as if something very important were happening. For a moment he looked just like he had so many years ago, his hair falling into his face, his whole attention fixed on Stanley like nothing in the world was more important than this robotic creature. Suddenly his attention was called upward, and his face lit up as he pointed.
Your big girl closet, it's open,
he exclaimed, getting back to his feet and approaching the tallest of the three closets, which was hanging open slightly. He pulled it open all the way, then leaned in, finding it empty.
So what was in it all those years?
He asked.
Not sure, Charlie said with a shrug. I sort of remember Aunt Jen bringing me back at some point, but I could be wrong. Maybe it was full of clothes that I was finally big enough to wear. Aunt Jen was always thrifty. Why spend money on new clothes if you don't have to, right?
She smiled. John glanced briefly at the smaller closets, but he left them alone.
I'm going to see if I can find any photo albums or paperwork, Charlie said, and she nodded absently as Stanley rattled back to his starting point.
As she left the room, she heard him starting up again, making another round on the track. The room that had been her father's was next to Charlie's. It was at the back of the house, and it had too many windows. In the summer it was too hot, and in the winter the cold dribbled in like a persistent leak, but Charlie had known without being told why he used it. From here you could see the garage and his workshop. It had always made sense to Charlie. That was his place, like a part of him always lived there, and he did not like to be too far away from his touchstone. A wave from her dream came to her for a moment, not even an image, just a strange, evocative gesture of memory. She frowned, looking out the window at the closed, silent garage door. Or maybe he just wanted to be sure nothing got out, she thought. She broke away from the window, shrugging her shoulders and shaking her hands, sloughing off the feeling. She looked around the room. Like her own, it was all but untouched. She did not open the drawers to his dresser, but for all she knew, it might still have been filled with shirts and socks, clean, folded, and ready to wear. His bed was made crisply, covered in the plaid blanket he used as a bedspread after Charlie's mother left, when there was no one to insist on white linen. There was a large bookcase against one wall, and it was still stuffed with books. Charlie went over and began scanning the shelves. Many were textbooks, engineering tomes whose titles meant nothing to her, and the rest were nonfiction, a collection that would have seemed eclectic to anyone who did not know the man. There were books on biology and anatomy, some on human beings and others on animals. There were books about the history of the traveling carnival and of the circus. There were books about child development, about myths and legends, and about sewing patterns and techniques. There were volumes that claimed to be about trickster gods, about quilting bees, and about football cheering squads and their mascots. On the very top shelf were stacks of file folders, and the bottom shelf was empty except for a single book, a photo album, leather-bound and as pristine as time and dust could allow. Charlie grabbed it, and it stuck for a moment, almost too tall for the low shelf it had been given. After a minute, it came free, and she headed back to her bedroom, leaving the door open with the sudden sense that if it closed, she might never get back in. John was sitting on the bed when she returned, looking at Stanley with his head tilted to the side. "What?" Charlie said, and he looked up, still pensive.
"I was wondering if he's been lonely," he said, then shrugged.
"He's got Theodore," Charlie said, pointing to the stuffed rabbit with a smile. "It's Ella who's all alone in the closet. Watch." She placed the album beside John on the bed and went to its foot, then turned the wheel that set Ella on her track. She sat down beside him, and they watched together, spellbound as of old, as the little doll came out in her crisp, clean dress to blankly offer tea. Neither of them spoke until the smallest closet door closed behind her. John cleared his throat.
"So, what's in the book?"
"Photos," Charlie said. "I haven't looked at them yet." She picked up the album and opened it at random. The top picture was of her mother holding a baby, maybe a year old. She held the child above her head, flying it like an airplane, her head thrown back in the midst of a laugh, her long brown hair swinging out in an arc behind her. The baby's eyes were wide, its mouth open in delight. John smiled at her.
"You look so happy," he said, and she nodded.
"Yeah," she said. "I guess I must have been. If that's me," she did not add aloud. She opened to another page, where the only picture was a large family portrait, stiffly posed at a studio. They were dressed formally. Charlie's father was wearing a suit. Her mother was in a bright pink dress with padding that lifted her shoulders almost to her ears, and her brown hair was straightened flat in place. Each of them was holding a baby, one in a white frilly dress, and one in a sailor suit. Charlie's heart skipped, and beside her she heard John take a sharp, quick breath. She looked at him with a feeling like the floor was dropping away beneath them.
"It was real," she said. "I didn't imagine him."
John said nothing in response, just nodded. He put a hand on her shoulder briefly, and then they turned back to the photo album.
"We all looked so happy," Charlie said softly.
"I think you were," John said. "Look, you had such a goofy smile."
He pointed, and Charlie laughed. The whole book was like that, the first memories of a happy family who expected there to be many more. They were not arranged chronologically, so Charlie and Sammy appeared as toddlers, then as newborns, then at various stages in between, except on formal occasions when Charlie was put into a dress, of which there seemed to be few. It was impossible to tell which baby was which. There were no traces of Fred Bear's family diner. Near the back of the book, Charlie came to a Polaroid of her and Sammy together, infants bright red and squalling on their backs, wearing nothing but diapers and hospital wristbands. On the white space below the picture, someone had written, "Mama's boy and Daddy's girl." The rest of the pages were blank. Charlie went back again, opening at random to find a strip from a photo booth, four shots of her parents alone. They smiled at each other, then made faces at the camera, then laughed, missing the chance to pose and blurring their faces. Lastly, they smiled into the lens. Her mother was beaming happily at the camera, her face alight and flushed, but her father was staring into the distance, a smile fixed on his face like he had left it there by mistake. His dark eyes were intense, remote, and Charlie resisted a sudden urge to look behind her, as if she might see whatever it was he was looking at. She peeled back the cellophane from the album's page and took the strip out, then folded it in half, careful to place the crease between pictures, leaving them intact. She slipped the pictures into her pocket and looked at John, who was watching her again, as if she were some kind of unpredictable creature he needed to be careful around.
"What?"
she said.
"Charlie, you know I don't think he did it, right?" You said that. I'm serious. It's not just what Carlton's dad said. I knew him, as well as a kid can know some other kid's dad. He wouldn't do it. I wouldn't believe it.
He spoke with calm certainty, like someone who believed that the world was made out of facts and tangible things, and that there was such a thing as truth.
Charlie nodded.
I know, she said.
She took her next breath slowly, gathering the words she would speak with it.
But I might.
His eyes widened, startled, and she looked up at the ceiling for a minute, briefly trying to remember if all the cracks had been there when she was a child.
I don't mean I think he did it. I don't think that, she said. I don't think about it at all. I can't. I shut the whole thing off in my mind the day I left Hurricane. I don't think about Freddy's. I don't think about what happened. And I don't think about him.
John was looking at her like she was monstrous, like what she was saying was the worst thing he had ever heard.
I don't understand how you can say things like that, he said quietly. You loved him. How can you even consider the possibility that he would do something so terrible?
Even the people who do terrible things have people who love them. Charlie was looking for words. I don't think he did it. I'm not saying that, she said again. And again the words hit the air as flimsy as paper. But I remember him dressing up for us in the yellow Freddy suit, doing the dances, miming along with the songs. It was so much a part of him. He was the restaurant. There was no one else. And he was always so distant, like in that picture. There was always something else going on beneath the surface. It was like he had a real life and a secret life, you know?
John nodded and looked about to speak, but Charlie rushed on before he could.
We were the secret life. His real life was his work. It was what mattered. We were his guilty pleasure, the thing he got to love and sneak away to have time with, something he kept hidden away from the dangers of what he did in his real world. And when he was with us, there was always a part of him that was back in reality, whatever that was for him.
Again, John opened his mouth, but Charlie snapped the photo album shut, stood up, and left the room.
John didn't follow right away, and as she traversed the short hall to her father's bedroom, she could almost hear him making up his mind. Not waiting for him, she went to the bookshelf, wanting to get the book out of her hands, like maybe if it were closed up and put away, her mind, too, would return to its normal order. The book would not fit, and she dropped to her knees to get a better angle, trying to jam the thing back where it belonged, get it out of her hands. The shelf seemed to have shrunk, sunk down while she was gone, so that it could never be returned, never put right. With a cry of frustration, Charlie shoved the photo album in as hard as she could. The shelf rocked back and then forward, and a sudden mass of papers and file folders tumbled from above her. Charlie began to cry as pages drifted down around her, covering the floor like snow as she wept. Swiftly, John was there. He knelt down with her in the delicate wreckage, clearing papers away as quickly as he could without tearing them. He put a hand on her shoulder carefully, and she did not move away. He pulled her close and held her, and she hugged him back, gripping so tight she knew she must be hurting him, but she could not let go. She sobbed harder, as if being held, being contained, made it safe to let go. Long minutes passed. John stroked her hair, and Charlie still cried, her body shaking with the force of it, shuddering like she was possessed. She was not thinking of what had happened, not flitting from one memory to the next to mourn for them all. Her mind was all but blank. She held nothing, was nothing, but this feeling of racking sobs. Her face was sore with tension, her chest hurt like all her pain was being forced out through its wall, and still she cried as if she would cry forever. But forever was an illusion. Slowly her breathing calmed, and finally Charlie returned to herself and pushed away from John's shoulder, exhausted. Once again, John was left with his arms partially suspended in the air, caught off guard by their sudden emptiness. He tried to move out of the awkward pose without calling attention to himself. Charlie sat back against the side of her father's bed, leaning her head against it. She felt wrung out, stretched thin and aged, but she felt a little better. She gave John a tiny smile, and she saw relief pass over his face at this first sign that she might be all right.
"I'm okay," she said. "It's just this place. It's all this."
She felt silly trying to explain, but John scooted back to sit with her.
"Charlie, you don't have to explain. I know what happened."
"Do you?"
She looked at him searchingly, not sure how to put the question. It seemed too crude, too graphic, to say it outright.
"Do you know how my dad died, John?"
He looked immediately nervous.
"I know he killed himself," he said hesitantly.
"No, I mean, do you know how?"
"Oh."
John looked down at his feet as if he could not meet her eyes.
"I thought he stabbed himself," he said quietly. "I remember hearing my mom and dad talk. She said something about a knife, and all the blood."
"There was a knife," Charlie said. "And there was blood."
She closed her eyes and kept them shut as she talked. She could feel John's eyes on her face, watching every movement, but she knew if she looked at him, she would not be able to finish.
"I never saw it," she said. "I mean, I never saw the body. I don't know if you remember, but my aunt came to get me at school in the middle of the day."
She stopped, waiting for confirmation, her eyes shut tight.
"I remember," John's voice said from the darkness. "It was the last time I ever saw you."
"Yeah. She came and got me, and I knew something was wrong. You don't go home from school in the middle of the day because everything's fine. She took me outside to her car, but we didn't get in right away. She picked me up and set me on the hood of the car, and she told me she loved me."
"I love you, Charlie, and everything is going to be okay," Aunt Jen said.
And then she destroyed the world with the next words she spoke. "She told me that my father had died, and she asked if I knew what that meant." And Charlie nodded, because she did know, and because, with an awful prescience, she was not surprised. "She said I was going to stay with her for a couple of days, and we would go get some clothes from the house. When we got there, she picked me up like I was a little kid, and as we went through the door, she covered my face with her hand so I wouldn't see what was in the living room. But I did see. It was one of his creatures, one she had never seen, and it was facing the stairs. Its head was bowed a little so that Charlie could see that the back of its skull was open, the circuits exposed. The limbs and joints lay bare, a skeleton of naked metal strung with twisting wires of bloodless circulation, and its arms were outstretched in a lonesome facsimile of an embrace. It was standing in the middle of a dark, still pool of some liquid that seemed, though it must have been imperceptible, to be spreading. She could see its face, if it could be called a face. Its features were scarcely formed, crude and shapeless. Even so, Charlie could see that they were contorted, almost grotesque. The thing would be weeping, if it could have wept. She stared at it for ages, though it could have been less than seconds, no more than a glimpse as Aunt Jen swept her up the stairs. Yet she had seen it so many times since then, when she slept, when she woke, when she unguardedly closed her eyes. It would appear to her, the face pressing its way into her mind as it had pressed into the world. Its blind eyes were only raised bumps like the eyes of a statue, seeing nothing but its own grief. In its hand, almost an afterthought, was the knife. When Charlie saw the knife, the whole thing snapped into focus. She knew what the thing was, and she knew what it had been built for.
John was staring at her, horror creeping in.
That's how he trailed off.
Charlie nodded.
Of course.
He made a move to comfort her again, but it was the wrong thing to do. Without thinking, Charlie moved slightly, slipping out of reach, and his face fell.
Sorry, she said quickly. I just... sorry.
John shook his head quickly and turned to the jumble of papers on the floor.
We should look through these, see if there's anything here, he said.
Sure, she said brusquely, dismissing his attempts at reassurance.
They began randomly. Everything had fallen in such a mess that there was no other way to begin. Most of the papers were engineering blueprints and pages of equations, incomprehensible to them both. There were tax forms, which John took up eagerly, hoping for information about Fred Bear's family diner, but he gave up with a sigh after 15 minutes, flinging the papers down.
Charlie, I can't figure this out. Let's check through the rest, but I don't think puzzling at it is going to turn us into mathematicians or accountants.
Stubbornly, Charlie kept picking through the papers, hoping for something she would understand. She picked up a sheaf of paper, trying to straighten the next stack, and a photograph fell out from the pile. John snatched it up.
Charlie, look, he said,
suddenly excited. She took it from his hand. It was her father, in his workshop, wearing the yellow Freddy Fazbear costume. The head was tucked under his arm, staring sightlessly into the camera, but Charlie's father was smiling, his face pink and sweaty as if he had been in the costume for a long time. Beside him was a yellow Bonnie.
The yellow rabbit, Charlie said. Jason said there was a yellow rabbit.
But your father is in the bear costume.
The rabbit must be a robot, Charlie said. Look at the eyes, they're red.
She peered closer. The eyes were glinting red, but they weren't glowing, and in a moment she saw why.
It's not red eyes, it's red eye. There's a person in there.
So who?
Who is in the suit?
Charlie finished the question for him.
We have to go to the library, John said, jumping to his feet.
Charlie stayed where she was, still staring down at the picture.
Charlie?
Yeah, she said.
He held out a hand to pull her up. As they descended the staircase, John hung back briefly, but Charlie did not turn around. She knew what he was imagining, because she was picturing it too. The stain on the floor, slowly spreading.
Charlie drove fast to the library, a grim urgency hanging over her. The promised storm was in the air, the smell of it rising like a warning. In a strange way, the worsening weather satisfied something in Charlie. Storms inside, storms outside.
I've never been this eager to get to the library, John joked, and she smiled tightly, without humor.
The main library in Hurricane was next to the elementary school where they had gone for the memorial ceremony, and as they got out of the car, Charlie glanced at the playground, envisioning children screaming and laughing as they ran circles, immersed in their games.
You were so young.
They hurried up the few steps to the library together, a square, modern brick building that looked as if it had come paired with the school beside it. She only remembered the library vaguely from her childhood. They had gone in frequently, and Charlie had spent all her time there sitting on the floor in the children's section. Being able to see over the information desk was slightly disconcerting. The librarian was young, Charlie thought, an athletic-seeming woman in slacks and a purple sweater. She smiled brightly.
What can I do for you? She said.
Charlie hesitated. The woman was maybe in her late 20s. Charlie realized that ever since she returned to Hurricane, she had been paying attention to age, scrutinizing each face and calculating how old they had been when it happened. This woman would have been a teenager.
It doesn't matter, she thought. You still have to ask.
She opened her mouth to ask for information about Fred Bear's, but what came out instead was,
Are you from Hurricane?
The librarian shook her head.
No, I'm from Indiana.
Charlie felt her body relax.
She wasn't here.
Do you have any information on a place called Fred Bear's Family Diner? Charlie asked, and the woman frowned.
Do you mean Freddy Fazbear's? They used to have one of those here, I think, she said vaguely.
No, that's not the one, Charlie said, ready to be endlessly patient with the librarian, who was, thankfully, probably the only person in town who was somehow unaware of her history.
Well, for town records, things like incorporation and licensing, you would have to go to City Hall, but it's...
She checked her watch.
It's after 5, so not today anyway. I have newspapers all the way back to the 1880s if you want to look at microfilm, she said eagerly.
Yeah, okay, Charlie said.
I'm Harriet, the woman said as she led them to a door at the back of the building.
They recited their names dutifully, and she chattered on like a child about to display her favorite toy.
So you know what microfilm is, right? It's because we can't keep stacks and stacks of papers here. There's no room, and eventually they would rot, so it's a way to preserve them. They take pictures and save the film. It's almost like a movie reel, you know? Very small, so you need a machine to see it.
We know what it is, John cut in when she paused. We just don't know how to use it.
Well, that's what I'm here for, Harriet declared and threw the door open.
Inside was a table with a computer monitor. The monitor sat on top of a little box with a small wheel on each side. Two handles stuck out in front. Charlie and John looked at it bemusedly, and Harriet grinned.
You want the local paper, right? What years?
Charlie counted backward. 1979 to 1982? She hazarded. Harriet beamed and left the room. John bent forward to peer at the machine, rattling the handles a little.
Careful, Charlie warned jokingly. I think she might be lost without that thing.
John raised his hands to his shoulders and stepped back. Harriet reappeared with what looked like 4 small movie reels and held them up.
What year do you want to start with? She said. 1979?
I guess, Charlie said, and Harriet nodded. She went to the machine and threaded the film through expertly. She flipped a switch and the screen came to life. A newspaper appeared.
January 1st, 1979,
John announced, leaning forward to read the headlines.
Politics, somebody won a sports game, and there was some weather. Also, there was a bakery giving away free cookies to celebrate the new year. Sounds like now, except no cookies.
You use these to see more, Harriet said, manipulating the controls. Let me know if you need help switching the reels. Have fun, you two.
She winked conspiratorially and closed the door behind her as she left. Charlie positioned herself in front of the machine, and John stood behind her, his hand on her chair. It felt good to have him close, like he would stop anything that tried to sneak up on her.
This is pretty cool,
he remarked, and she nodded, scanning the paper for answers.
Okay, let's narrow it down, he said grimly. What's the thing most likely to make the papers?
I was looking for an opening announcement, Charlie said.
Yeah, but what's going to make the papers?
Sorry, he added.
I didn't want to say it, but we have to.
Sammy, Charlie said. We should have started with Sammy. We moved to the new house when I was 3. It's got to be 1982.
Carefully, they switched the reel. Charlie eyed the door as they did, as if nervous that Harriet might catch them making a mistake.
When's your birthday? John said, sitting to take her place.
Don't you know? She teased.
He screwed up his face in an exaggerated mime of thinking.
May 13th, he said at last.
She laughed, startled.
How did you know?
He grinned up at her.
Because I know things, he said.
But why does it matter?
You remember being 3 when you moved, but you didn't turn 3 until May, so we knock out 5 months.
Do you remember anything about the restaurant the night Sammy disappeared?
Charlie felt herself flinch with an almost physical pain.
Sorry, she said. Her face felt too hot. Sorry, you startled me. Let me think.
She closed her eyes.
The restaurant.
The closet, hung full with costumes. She and Sammy, there safe in the dark, until the door opened and the rabbit appeared, leaning over them with its awful face, its human eyes. Charlie's heart was racing. She slowed her breathing and held out a hand. John took hold of it. She held on tight, as if he could anchor her. The rabbit leaning over them, the yellow teeth beneath the mask, and behind the rabbit. What was behind the rabbit? The restaurant was open. She could hear voices, people. There were more people in costumes. Other performers? Robots? No. She almost had it. Scarcely breathing, Charlie tried to coax out the thought, scared to frighten it away. Move slowly, speak softly. She had it, snatched it from the depths of her mind and held it wriggling in her fingers. Her eyes snapped open. John, I know when it was, she said. Earlier that night, when they were still wide awake, the closet opened and her mother looked in. She was haloed by the light from behind her, smiling down at her twins, radiant in her long, elegant dress, her flowing hair, her gleaming tiara.
Mommy's a princess, Charlie murmured sleepily, and her mother bent down and kissed her cheek.
Just for tonight, she whispered, and then she left them in the dark to sleep.
She was a princess, she said excitedly.
What?
Who?
My mother, Charlie said. She was dressed up as a princess. It was a Halloween party. John, go to November 1st.
John struggled briefly with the controls, and then it was there. The headline was small, but it was on the front page of the paper on Monday, November 1st. Toddler snatched. Charlie turned away. John began to read aloud, and Charlie cut in, stopping him.
Don't, she said. Just tell me if it has anything useful.
He was quiet, and she stared anxiously at the door, waiting, tracing the knots in the false wood with her eyes.
There's a picture, he said finally. You need to look.
She leaned over his shoulder. The story had continued over an entire page inside, with pictures of the restaurant, of the family all together, and of her and of Sammy, though neither of the twins were named in the article. In the bottom left corner, there was a picture of her father and another man. Their arms were slung around each other's shoulders, and they were grinning happily.
John, Charlie said.
It says they were joint owners, John said quietly.
No,
Charlie said, unable to take her eyes from the picture, from the face they both knew. Suddenly, the door behind them erupted in pounding from outside, and they both jumped.
Charlie? John? Are you in there?
Marla, they said as one, and Charlie rushed to the door and threw it open.
Marla, what is it?
She was red-faced and breathless, and Harriet was anxiously hovering behind her. Marla's hair was wet. Water dripped down her face, but she did not wipe it away or even seem to notice.
I guess the rain started, Charlie thought,
the mundane reflection drifting unbidden into her head despite her alarm.
He's gone! Jason's gone! Marla cried.
What?
John said.
He's gone back to Freddy's. I know he has, she said. He kept saying we should go back, that we shouldn't just be hanging around all day. I thought he was in another room, but I looked everywhere. I know that's where he is.
She said it all in one breath and ended gasping, a faint, whining hum resonating under her breathing, a keening sound she seemed unable to stop making.
Oh, no, Charlie said. Come on,
Marla pressed. She was jittering, vibrating. John put a hand on her shoulder as if to comfort her, and she shook her head.
Don't try to calm me down. Just come with me, she insisted. But there was no anger, only desperation. She turned and almost ran to the door, and John and Charlie followed with an apologetic look for the bemused librarian they left behind them.